Chapter 27. Haveia. Panic. Screaming. Entreaties to a divinity or imprecations against an uncaring universe. Was that what Tolemier had been expecting? If so, he was going to be disappointed. Although, if he'd been hoping for dumbfounded silence, at least he had that. Haveia could see that the vulture god's crew had also been caught on the hop. They were goggling at their navigator, and the lawyer Almier was whispering something. Surely something like, "No, seriously, what?" "Menhir Tolemier," Monitor Superior Tact recovered first. "Perhaps you would like to elaborate."
"They're back! They were there! In Unspace!"
Idris waved his hands, clutching at something that Colval had no good words for.
"I felt them!"
"It's understandable that architects were on your mind, given what you found," said Borodin sympathetically. "You survived the war. We understand that. But we have Delegate Trine's report on the Amaru, and our own technicians concur with their interpretation of the data. It was a deftly managed hoax."
"It's true, Idris," Ollie and Timo added.
She looked disgruntled about having to agree with Borodin, or perhaps with anyone.
"That son of a bitch said he'd done it. Or for the greater good or some bollocks. You know how they talk."
Idris was holding hard to the arms of his chair, shaking. "That's some powerful PTSD," Mundy thought. "God, someone should just get him out of here."
"You don't understand," he said,
each word forced out between clenched teeth.
"In Unspace, when I was dodging the Broken Harvest, I had to go so deep to escape. I could feel their pilot's mind hunting me, like a beast."
He shuddered.
"And I'd gone so far to get away, cut off from every throughway."
He swallowed hard.
"And they were there, moving in the deep, coming back, like a wave across the universe."
"Menhir Tolemier, perhaps you should collect your thoughts in appropriate quarters," Tact said.
Not in the infirmary, which Mundy reckoned was what got cut off. Why make the poor bastard sound any more mad than he already is?
"Our requirements regarding our citizens have not changed," Borodin said flatly. "Monitor, we know how convenient it would be if some fiction of the architect's return spread across the colonies. Convenient for the hegemonic cult, yes, but also for the Parthenon."
"Are you accusing us of having any hand in this hoax?"
"No, emphatically no," Borodin said, dismissing her suggestion. "However, I know full well that I'd be making what hay I could out of it, if it helped me. A wave of panic about the architects would give you a great deal of leverage at the table. The warrior angel's here to protect us all, isn't that right? We'll debrief Tolemier back on Berlinhof and share the results with you."
"Appropriately redacted, of course," Tact noted.
"Of course."
Haveia watched the Vulture God crew arguing inaudibly because they turned their mic off again. Seeing the utter certainty on the Int's face, he felt a worm of worry inside him. Obviously, Lucef Borodin was walking the appropriate party line, but Tact had leant back to listen to the officer behind her, and now she nodded sharply.
"Your solution is unacceptable," she told Borodin. "The stakes have just become too high to simply let this crew vanish into Hugh custody. With all respect to Mynheer Tolemier, Borodin said patiently, the stakes have not changed at all.
Listen to me!
The intermediary burst in again, now twice as loud because their tech was having fun with the sound system.
Both of you! Why are you still having this conversation?
Mynheer Tolemier, please, Borodin said exasperated. I am a representative of your government attempting to free you from the hands of a foreign power. Will you just... What if we don't want to go? Almier put in. Hervea Mundi was close enough to see Borodin tense in anger and marvelled at how little of it made its way into his voice.
Madame Almier, the legal implications of such a defection are rather complex. You and your fellows were involved in a series of criminal actions aboard Lungkro Station, followed by an act of piracy over Terracuma. You are now in possession of sensitive information and resources at a time of diplomatic crisis, and you are suggesting you might join a military rival. Lungkro was under hegemonic jurisdiction at all relevant times, Almier continued. Good luck bringing the Broken Harvest to the dock to give evidence on how we got our ship back from them, and I will fight you in any court you care to name about our right to freedom of association and movement, Mynheer Borodin. But we are not defecting to the Parthenon, nor are we meekly going to accompany you either, mostly because Idris thinks you'll give him to the liaison board, and he really doesn't want to have anything to do with those butchers. I appreciate that courtroom theatrics are your stock in trade, Borodin crowbarred in, but you appear to have reasoned yourself into a corner. So, you're not going with us or them. What's next?
We are placing ourselves in the neutral hands of the Hiver Assembly, Almier declared brightly, specifically as represented by Delegate Trine. For the time being, we'll sit in our ship, and our ship can sit right here in the Bay of the Heaven Sword. Unless you'd rather we took the Vulture God to Berlinhof's Hiver diplomatic orbital. If we remain here, under Trine's auspices, we all know it's basically a fiction to keep us out of anyone's hands. Whereas if we actually go to the Hiver Embassy, the Hivers are likely to have questions, don't you think? So I suggest you allow us to stay here and talk to whoever we want. You can both keep an eye on us that way, to make sure the other party doesn't just bundle us in a bag and cart us off. See, right?
Hervea was working hard to keep a straight face. Borodin and Takt were just staring. Takt recovered first.
Well, then, as a temporary measure, that will be acceptable.
There was more, but Hervea was distracted by Tolemier, as the man stared across the room, at him.
At me? Man, this is out of my hands.
But Hervea wasn't the focus of Telemier's gaze. Saint Xavier was sitting beside him, and Hervea saw she was staring right back. Some communication passed between the intermediaries. Some, I told you so, from one int to the mother of them all. And she looked 10 years older for it, as though she might collapse at any moment. The diplomats were still wrangling, but it was more for form's sake than anything else now, and at least they had a plan to follow. Minutes after they had filed out of the room, Hervea was talking to Mordant House about the urgent need for him to go see the new asylum seekers. Getting to visit them involved the usual fun and games,
but Hevea had all the right hue clearances. Both sets of guards outside the Vulture God still stared at him, though. He expected he'd cut an odd figure in his scarecrow way, but he reckoned he'd do better than Borodin in his expensively tailored suit. That would get right up the nose of any spacer, and this lot were punchier than most. He was met by Kittering, the Hanilambra, because why not bring yet another citizenry into play? The alien shield arms bore screens displaying a complex pattern of silver lines on black. "What's that?" Hevea couldn't help but ask. "Behold, the flag of the Hiver Assembly," the Hanis translator declared proudly. Hevea suspected they were making a fool of him. "When did they get one exactly?" "For purpose of entering into contract with my kinsmen. Heraldry is always appreciated." Kittering made a show of examining Hevea's unornamented black clothes. "Eyes are wasted on humans sometimes." "I consider myself properly told," Hevea said. "Look, you probably think I'm here to put the screws on for Mordant House. Offer you something that serves you and fucks the Partheni, that kind of thing."
"All the lights," Kittering exclaimed.
The figure of speech was opaque, but the artificial tone suggested agreement, and not friendly agreement.
"I just want to talk to Telemier," Hevea said. "I'm actually not part of the official delegation. I'm following a hunch."
It struck him that his own figure of speech might not translate well to a species without shoulders.
"Don't have to meet him alone. Everyone's invited. I have one question, really. That's all it is."
Soon after, he found himself in the Vulture God's drone bay, perhaps the only room big enough to contain them all. The actual drones had been moved to the walls to make space, resting near a remarkable mess of disconnected wires and general mechanical gubbins. Someone had printed out a set of the cheapest plastic chairs he'd ever seen. Almier and Telemier were sitting on two of them, side by side like they were going to give a prepared statement. She was sleekly elegant, in a new gold scarf and formal suit. Telemier still wore his drab spacer's clothes, looking small and unwell. A man at the fulcrum of events who wasn't prospering under the attention. Solis stood behind the Ince chair, with her actual accelerator in her hands. She'd left off the armour, but the weapon could shoot someone three rooms away. Once again, Hevea considered himself properly told.
"I'm not an assassin, by the way," Hevea started. "I appreciate that's also what an assassin would say, but just to clear the air."
Teemo entered at that point, in a damaged-looking walker frame that still had half its panels off.
"You again," she observed.
"Hi."
She shook her head.
"Just don't take too long. I need to work in here."
Then she left, apparently not at all interested in whatever he had to say. Kittering had scrambled up onto another chair and was perched there precariously. Hevea found a smile hard to put off.
"You know, I do get to go to embassy functions now and then," he told them,
lowering himself into a seat and hearing the cheap plastic creak.
"I know just the sort of well-dressed backs you're trying to put out with this sort of carnival. Make do and mend, right? Spacer diplomacy."
Almier sent a complicit look towards Kittering, face too deadpan. And then the Hiver Trine came in with a tray. The aroma of something like biscuits gusted in with them, just off enough to suggest the Vulture's food printer needed looking at. Trine bent low before Hevea, proffering the tray in a lattice of their chest-mounted arms.
"As I am now apparently some manner of ambassador, my honoured guest, it is only appropriate that I extend what hospitality I may," the Hiver announced.
Their translucent face bore an expression of snooty disdain.
"Have a cookie."
Hevea took one. Please tell me you'll put on this same show for Borodin intact. Let me have a media type of it, in fact, so I can watch them rupture their etiquette.
Indubitably, Trine assured him. Now you'll be wanting some manner of electronic privacy.
Actually, this isn't even gov business, not even spy business, Hevea said. This is just me with my police hat on, trying to tie off an investigation. Just me trying to get my report square before I hand it in and go off the case.
That had their attention. They'd only put on this act to put unwelcome visitors' noses out of joint. It was only Telemier who wasn't enjoying their 5 minutes of fame.
Go ahead, Almier said cautiously. Why'd you come to Berlinoff? He asked, flat out.
When we met, you said we should come here, and...
Almier began.
Hevea was only looking at Telemier, but he answered her anyway.
I know I said you should come here. But even when I did, I thought, why the hell would you? With a whole universe at your fingertips, why would you suddenly get a dose of the law-abiding and hand yourselves in? Since when did you people do anything anyone told you to without a contract?
You're excluding simple patriotism, the lawyer suggested.
You know what? I absolutely am, he agreed. Monsieur Telemier, was it your decision?
Yes.
The int was staring at his own toes. So tell me why. Did you decide you wanted to do the right thing? Or was it chance even that you ended up here?
Hevea pressed. I want to understand.
Berlinhof was like a beacon, came to Lemier's quiet, worn voice. Could see it from across the universe. The grave marker of the architect we killed here.
Solace put a hand on his shoulder, and he unconsciously covered it with his own.
And we were lost by then. Too many jumps. Too far out. But that marker I could follow.
What?
Hevea had jumped to his feet. They were all staring at him, these ragged diplomats, as though he was the strange one.
What is it? Almier pressed. Agent Mundy?
In his mind, he heard the int's voice at the hearing, telling of the storm coming from the deeps, the great fleet of the architects returning from the unthinkable vast places they had retreated to. It was like a beacon.
You've been very helpful, he managed, dry-throated.
Then, from sheer force of habit, he added,
We'll be in touch.
He did not, in fact, return to Borodin and Stoll to help them plan their negotiation. Instead, it was time to call home. Chief Larry didn't make him wait, which suggested either it was a slow day for spying, or she was also having some worried thoughts about the whole business herself.
So the int believes his story? She asked him.
For what it's worth, yes. I mean, we both know they do burn out, go scatty. And this one's been around as long as any, aside from St. Zav herself. But it's not some scam they're running, that's for certain. Despite how the Amaru turned out, he's absolutely convinced.
And
St. Zav looked like she was taking him very seriously.
The saint dodged her handlers recently, Larry said sourly. But our data suggests she met with the Harbinger.
She rolled her eyes.
Saints, Harbingers. Our predecessors could have been less fucking messianic with their naming conventions.
At his raised eyebrows, her image waved an emaciated hand.
Oh, forgive me, not been sleeping well since forever. It's just that Ash has been poking around, making his own inquiries into this business. I have never liked or trusted that creature.
Ash had been an established appendage of the colonial government since long before Larry was born. Mordaunt House's successive directors had never appreciated the ancient alien's meddling. "We don't know how it knows what it knows," she complained, "and I do not believe in magic or seeing the future."
"Nobody believed in Unspace once," Hevea said, unwisely, to judge from her expression.
"Chief, I don't know the truth of it, but I don't think Telemier's fooling around here is all. Unscientific as it is, my gut feeling says we're in trouble."
He swallowed.
"How unhappy would I be if I asked about the evacuation protocols for Berlinhof?"
Larry stared at him, stony-faced.
"I am glad," she said, "that this is a heavily encrypted channel, because we couldn't have realistically evacuated 10% of the planet, even during the war, since which time the population has increased fourfold, and nobody has their go-bag and a map to their closest evac centre. So let's not say things like that in earshot of anyone prone to panic, shall we?"
He wanted to say, "But what if?" But she told him the what if. Simply put, there was no what if, any more than there had been with Earth. And just as with Ash's warning to Earth, nobody was going to completely dismantle the heart of the human sphere just because of a crazy prophet. Except,
"He said Berlinhof was a beacon."
"Telemier? He said he could see it from right across Unspace."
"And nobody else has noticed this?" Larry demanded.
"There aren't that many ints. Almost none left who were at that final battle. And maybe it's like city lights obscuring the stars. You need to get further out into the countryside before you can see them clearly."
"Or some damn thing."
Hevea grimaced.
"I have bad feelings, Chief."
And she nodded, soberly. He slept on it, or tried to. The Partheni had given over a whole student dorm to Hugh's negotiating team. There were 40 beds and just a handful of occupants, but the sparse Partheni design robbed the space of any sense of luxury. Spartan was the appropriate term, on a variety of levels. Hevea reflected gloomily that it was the colonies who were supposed to be poor, but colonial spaces were never plain. If you were rich, you showed it through having stuff that people could see. If you were poor, everything was patched and homemade and botched together. Being taller than the average Partheni, he ended up sleeping folded up in a weird position, so that something hidden down the side of the plastic mattress jabbed at his side. It turned out to be a media-type nib, just a thumb-sized data store. Filled with hopes of discovering Partheni secrets, he cracked it open, only to find it was crammed with episodes of some media type. It was prose and animation and voice drama, all about some girl from the colonies during the war. She was living on a ship, learning to be a pilot, but mostly she was arguing with rivals and having unrequited crushes on classmates of both genders. It was possibly the least historically accurate thing Hevea had ever seen. He ended up watching it for 3 hours solid, feeling a weird connection to whatever Partheni naval student's life he'd just invaded by finding her stash of cod colonial drama. And then he heard the alarms. His comms alert lit up like fireworks, and he knew it had happened.
"Architects over Berlinhof."
He wouldn't have been at all surprised, but what had actually happened was the first ships had come in from Far Lux. Far Lux?
The small packet runners had fled the system first, bringing urgent requests for emergency refugee facilities. And there were many more ships on the way. Every ship the mining colony could get into space, and several that shouldn't have tried it. And Far Lux had quite the population these days. An architect had come out of Unspace in the Far Lux system and begun cruising towards the defenceless colony planet. People had crammed every ship they could find. Far more had been left behind to watch that vast crystal moon approach, then witness the end of it all. But why Far Lux? Despite Tolemier's dire warnings about Berlinhof being a beacon, it was some far-flung colony making history. It was insignificant, except for one thing. Far Lux was where the peace had happened, where humanity's intermediaries had finally reached out and touched the universe's destructive gods. Three intermediaries. And one had been Idris Tolemier. Idris. They had spread the Ints wide after Berlinhof to try and protect the human sphere. The battle had at least proved that intermediaries could affect the architect's movements. Even slowing an attack would mean thousands more evacuated. And the intermediary program itself was constantly brainstorming, thinking up strategies, welcoming new ideas. St. Xavian, her Ints, and the program's researchers were working from first principles, assembling a patchwork science of suppositions and second guesses. Xavien was even discussing the unthinkable, making contact with their enemy. Idris had no idea if this was a colonial initiative or if she was off on her own. It wasn't as if anyone was qualified to oversee her. And her Ints would have done anything for her. After all, they had been born from pain and madness, with her as their midwife. And Idris had gone to Far Lux along with Ulumu Garrison and Tess Mangaline. And if their Partheni captain had rankled a little at letting these three colonials take turns in the pilot's chair, dragging her vessel hither and yon across the human sphere, well, that was tinted with the superstitious awe people had back then for the Ints. One thing Xavien had wanted was an early warning system. Ints were sensitive to the impending arrival of an architect. Idris remembered that from Berlinhof. He believed you could tell where they were going to arrive. Plenty of Ints did, although the actual hit rate of their predictions was too low to be useful. Still, his instincts had brought the three of them to the small mining colony in the little Partheni runner, Yenenga. They'd found it peaceful, going about its business. Idris had half felt that the appearance of the Yenenga in their skies should have been like a comet in the olden times, chaos and panic and portents of the end of days. And the Ints had delivered their warning, but the frightened colonials had just been angry at the false alarm. They'd chewed out the scaremongering Ints over the comms, because what were they supposed to do? Just pack up and leave? Because three crazy people told them it was the end of the world. Then all three Ints had gone dead silent, staggering as though the ship's agrav had faltered. 2 minutes later, the architect had torn its way into the system. It tumbled out of Unspace and righted itself, its million serried spines directed at the planet. Ulumu was a small, dark man, older than Idris as was. He'd die 2 years later, in space, as a spacer should, when the freighter he was piloting suffered a catastrophic systems failure at the exact moment it opened a path to Unspace. Tess was an angular woman, starveling thin, half her face a tinted plastic mask, because she wouldn't get her reconstructive surgery until after the war. Ints were too valuable to take out of circulation for that long. She'd join the cartography corps and bow out of colonial history that way, vanished into unspace, searching for new throughways and planetary systems, fate unknown, but not coming back. But they would live, to die later. All three of them would live, as would every soul aboard the Yenenga, and the entire population of Far Lux. For this was the day the war ended. There was no fleet gathered at Far Lux that day, no valiant holding action planned to buy time for an evacuation. Everyone planetside was simply running for the ships, for the landing fields. The orbital's personnel were clearing out already, all except for a skeleton staff, who stayed at their posts to coordinate the escape effort below. Idris had thought of them as the Yenenga moved forwards, a solitary mote against the immensity that was descending on the planet. Bureaucrats, data pushers, planners and accountants, they were all giving their lives to save just a few more families of miners and factory workers. Numb. He'd felt numb then. He'd been living through the Holocaust of war all his life, and he couldn't remember a single moment of security. Always the architects, ridding the galaxy of humanity, one world at a time. He'd spent his childhood crammed into the hold of one ship after another, his family lost long ago. Maybe they were dead, or just scattered by too many losses and too much stress. Then, as soon as he was old enough, he'd gone for active service. Because what else was there? The war didn't spare civilians anyway, so why not? As soon as he'd heard about the new intermediary program, he'd signed up for that too. He'd been chosen due to some arcane criteria he never understood, and he'd survived it, when most volunteers hadn't. He'd been remade into something else inside his head, something not quite human. Then he'd gone to war. He'd been at Berlinhof. He'd touched the mind of the enemy. And so it was war he wanted to bring. The three of them were a living spearhead, and they were going to stab into the brain of the oncoming architect. What else was there? Nobody thought they'd win. Not anymore. Perhaps they'd manage a nomadic existence, like the Neyramathi, limping from system to system, stripping worlds to build more ships so they could limp some more. Or perhaps they'd be gone, like Harbinger Ashes people. No doubt there were many other races they'd never know, because they had been so thoroughly and comprehensively removed from the universe. The Partheni captain knew they were courting death. She didn't hesitate, though. Idris and the others wanted to fly straight into the teeth of the architect, and so they went. They were a tiny fleck of dust against that barbed landscape as it readied itself to turn Far Lux into another barren sculpture. Idris imagined his mind like origami, small, so small, all the complexity of it folded down to a point so he could drive it deep into the vastness of the architect. They'd learn that whole expanse was the entity's mind, as well as its substance. He could feel Alumu and Tess making the same preparations. They couldn't coordinate, not quite, but they struck almost simultaneously. Their minds ranged across the outer reaches of the enemy, prying for a way in, becoming ever smaller, smaller, until they could slip their consciousnesses into the radiant labyrinth of its being. Then they could chase through the canals of its thoughts, looking for something to break, something to tear.
The voices of the Partheni crew were in his ears, reporting and receiving orders. Every slight variance within the architect was measured and broadcast back to the planet, so that the data could travel with the refugees and get back to the program. Because there was always another battle to prepare for, another lesson to learn. Nobody knew this would be the end. Idris struck. His mind was a lance, driven as far as it would go into his enemy. He sought vulnerable tissue, baffled by the sheer scale of it. As well try to stab a man to death with a needle an atom wide. He clawed at it. He screamed in the halls of its brain, beat his fists against the walls of its mind. And it didn't sense him. It felt the intrusion, but didn't understand what he was. He was turbulence, interference, static, a bad dream. But he was nothing it recognized in any meaningful way. The architect trembled ever so slightly as the three intermediaries tried to break it, and just shouldered on. Then the Yenenga fell back as the nightmare accelerated towards Far Lux. It had singled out the system's inhabited world, as architects always did, because they must have their art, and their art demanded death. No architect ever reworked a lifeless desert world into a planet-sized sculpture. Idris knew they understood the teeming lives they snuffed out, and he hated them for it. In that moment, something in him broke, and he made himself big again, inside its mind. He unfolded all that careful origami, shattered that needlepoint, pressed himself against every wall at once, inside his mind, inside its mind, and he pushed outwards. On the bridge of the Yenenga, he'd been screaming, lying on the floor with the captain shouting for a medic. He'd been rigid, muscles wrenching at bones, so that he'd ache for a solid month after. Idris's face had been awash with tears from clenched shut eyes. Blood flowed from his nose, spittle from his locked open mouth. And Idris had been there, with it. All that maze of complexity within the architect had focused, in that moment, into a single consciousness. This was an entity with the power to reshape worlds, and he had its attention. Not a mote of dust in its eye, not a pebble beneath its foot, or a thorn pricking its thumb. He had a mind, as it had a mind. He was a thing that, minuscule as he was, it saw as real. He'd roared in, hating, angry, terrified. He'd driven into the architect's mind on a flame of negative emotions, knowing only that it was the executioner of worlds. And now he touched the truth of it. He understood that until now, no human, perhaps no denizen of any planet it had ruined in its millennia of life, had ever existed for it. At his, its back was the world of Far Lux, and Idris could see through its senses that the planet was mottled with a kind of rot, a disfiguring decay that the architect needed to clear away. That rot was thought. The collected minds of all the people living there. They exerted a pressure on the fabric of space that the architect, for reasons Idris had never grasped, felt the need to release. For a measureless time, he and the architect had confronted one another. He had sampled the immensity of its mind, and it had taken a magnifying lens and studied him, as a human might examine a microbe, a thing so small that it might as well not be there at all.
He had no anger left at that point. There was nothing of the white hot fire that had taken him so far. Such emotions withered and died in the face of that godlike scrutiny. How foolish it was to rage over the deaths of so many microbes, the extermination of something almost invisible. Yet it saw him and understood him. Perhaps it unfolded the page of his mind to its fullest extent, ironing flat the crenulations of his brain until he was spread so thin and wide that he finally became visible to it. His past and present and all the complexities of his being, all exposed for study, as never before, and still the most insignificant thing the architect had ever been called upon to recognise. He'd stopped screaming then. He stared sightlessly towards the ceiling of the Yenenga's bridge as the medics restarted his heart and used machines to keep his lungs working. There was a moment he recognised as regret. He was never sure if he'd felt the being's regret over all its kind had done, or if this was some perverse personal response to the architect's departing, now they wouldn't be continuing their work. For they would not, he understood. For now, at least. And who knew what now meant to beings so vast? Perhaps they would go and think about what they'd done for 100 million years, before coming back to pick up where they'd left off. Perhaps they'd wait until the suns had all gone out and the universe was cold. The architect had fallen back into unspace and not returned. And that was the last anyone saw of them. That day was the last day of the war, although it was months before anyone dared suggest it was so. Decades later, in diplomatic isolation aboard the Vulture God, Idris caught the news out of Far Lux and felt as though someone had taken his guts out. It was all for nothing, he thought. But of course that wasn't true. Humanity had been given 50 years to consolidate and grow. People who would have died had been given decades to live. It had been his achievement, him and Tess and Alumu, and he the only survivor of the three. He had ended the war, there at Far Lux, and on the back of that, he tried to become irrelevant. Just be Idris Tolemier on a succession of crappy ships towards the outskirts of the human sphere. He'd had his fill of making history. Now sections of the Hugh administration on Berlinhof were being yanked out of decades-old mothballs. The next unspace shipment from Far Lux would be a wave of refugees. Everyone was scrambling to set up camps, kitchens, shelter, medical supplies. And at the same time, less savoury engines were turning their wheels.
"There's Sathiel, the fucker,"
Ollie said, jabbing a finger at the screen. They'd all crammed into command, where the Vulture was displaying rolling news.
"We should have had a sweepstake on it."
They could see the cult Hieragrave's benevolent white-bearded face. It was as if he'd never committed the biggest fraud of the last 40 years. Instead, he was talking animatedly about the protection the Essiel would be only too happy to extend, and for such a small price. Idris waited for the interviewer to mention the Amaru, but somehow it never came up. Suddenly the cult had gone from clowns in costumes to everyone's new best friend, someone who might be called upon for an urgent favour sometime soon. Two colonial warships had turned up at Berlinhof, ostensibly to defend against any architect incursion. Idris knew full well they'd have set off before the news broke,
and had come to lean on the Partheni.
"They want the regalia, of course,"
Trine announced mournfully, having lost his chance to work on the things,
"which are here on this very ship, a mere 100 metres away. And suddenly they are of a far more than academic interest to the authorities on Berlinhof."
"They could what? Just take them down there and make the whole planet architect-proof?"
Ollie asked him.
"I'd be willing to wager my ambassadorial status that Hugh is digging up absolutely everything it knows about the process, my old comrade in adversity,"
Trine agreed.
"And maybe it isn't anything more significant than just having the things there. We're all aware that the hegemony loves ritual for ritual's sake."
"But you don't have the regalia," Chris pointed out.
"No, they don't," Trine agreed. "But what coincidence. Suddenly they have warships here. How fortuitous."
"They can't just start shooting. How will that end?" demanded Chris.
"They think they'll be able to threaten and we'll cave," Solace said hollowly.
"But we won't. It's not what we do. Also, top-of-the-line colonial does not beat top-of-the-line us. They can't stop us just leaving if we want to go."
"Then why haven't you?" Ollie needled. "Just leg it. Everything's simpler for you if Berlinhof gets hit, right?"
Solace stared at her. "Hope," she said.
"Which one of you was Hope?"
the specialist asked blankly. "No, I mean the idea of hope." Solace frowned. "My people will be hoping we don't have to just walk away. They'll be hoping there's a diplomatic solution. And..."
"And what? They're going to be our warrior angels all over again. Throw themselves in the way if the architects come."
"Yes." Solace was blinking rapidly. "Yes, Ollie. Exactly that." Idris wondered how much of this vaunted hope was her own, that her people were still the heroes she remembered. She'd been in suspension for a long time, and the universe had turned.
"The angels of punching you in the face," he pronounced sadly, but ending with a smile. God knew, he needed something to lighten the mood.
Solace rounded on him, looking for mockery, finding none.
"Enquiry. Crew logistical arrangements on sudden failure of diplomacy,"
Kittering piped up. He'd been crouching in one corner, puzzling over his back screen, currently spread on the floor in several pieces.
"Good point. I'm guessing your people won't have time to just drop us off if you do decide to leg it home,"
Chris agreed. "Well," Solace shifted awkwardly, "they did ask, would you agree to come with us? I mean, war or peace, diplomacy or not, I'm supposed to ask."
"And if we say no, that means they let us go, right?"
Ollie asked, with heavy sarcasm.
"Maybe just give us a little hamper of rations for the journey? Complimentary mint candy, that kind of thing."
We would contract with you. On good terms. For the services of the Vulture God and all crew."
"So long as crew includes Idris,"
Chris finished for her.
"Why not just take him?"
Ollie said suddenly.
"I mean, you can. The Vulture's in your ship's hold. Even we were able to storm this damn bucket when we needed to. You have all the supermarines in the universe right outside the hatch. Why this goddamn pussyfooting around?"
"We don't want to. That's a step we can't untake. And what use are any of you under duress? You ever think about trying to force an int to do something, really? Hugh might have all the leash contracts in the world, but you can't tell me the liaison board doesn't invest massively in site conditioning too.
Maybe they have slaver cutouts and some killer implant to keep their hooks in even. Because it's like those birds they keep on Magda, the expensive hunting ones. The whole point of them is to let them fly. And if they fly, then maybe they never come back. But more than that, we don't want to. And I don't want to. At least consider a contract. Largesse or Halma or goods in kind. However you want it. Most spacer crews would be scrabbling over each other for this sort of deal. Is it so bad that it's us? Ollie opened her mouth for the quick retort, then shut it, looking around at her fellows. Fuck, she said at last. Actually, hate to admit it, that's not a bad pitch.
Well, it comes down to Idris, Chris noted. I mean, I'd be for it. I always wanted to see the Parthenon. But Idris?
He was silent. Their voices had become very far away. He was gripping the edge of the pilot's board to stop himself falling into the vast well he could feel forming. The jabber of the news mediotype had become no more than static. His name again, from Chris, then Solis. Then Ollie lifted a leg of her walker frame to prod him with its tip. There might have been the tinkle and clatter of Kit reassembling his screen, taping over the cracks. Trine's phantom face, with its vacant beatitude, all so far away. Just outside the ship, the curve of space fell into a void, pulled down by the leaden weight of nothingness. Gravity without mass, because its cause was on the other side of the membrane, in unspace. He knew that Saint Xavier would be feeling just this, wherever she was. And over where the liaison board plied its trade, its conscript intermediaries would be clutching at their heads, wailing, waking from nightmares, because none of the poor bastards would know what they were sensing. It hadn't happened before in their lifetimes. They weren't veterans, like him and Xavier.
It's coming, he told the crew. It's here.